This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Kathy Schoaf is a registered nurse and has a lot of other medical-related credentials to her name, but she is also a well-noted travel agent, a special travel agent, as a matter of fact. We've talked with her before about her business, which is called Elite Cruises and Vacations. It's based in Hobart, and they are basically a special needs travel agency, helping people out who have special needs, have them an opportunity to enjoy cruises and other vacation types of things that will certainly mean something very importantly to them. Well, how has Kathy been doing here with Elite Cruises and Vacations in the age of the COVID-19 pandemic? Let's find out more. Kathy, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, these are really tough times for everybody. We know for business people as well as for individuals having to deal with the coronavirus, with the special guidance that we've gotten in taking care of ourselves and how we carry ourselves through, literally, through life, it seems, these days, with the guidelines that have been issued to us. What in particular have you and other, I'm sure other special needs travel agents like yourself, but you in particular with Elite Cruises and Vacations been doing these days to help with your clients, the people that are interested in wanting to still take those trips and enjoy life?
Well, the answer is total honesty,
mm-hmm.
A transparent honesty. The answers are not always clear as to what this current situation is, but I have a lot of clients that are excited to get to travel. Their caregivers desperately need a break, especially in these times when they have literally been on house arrest for months.
Yeah.
And many of them are more than excited to still get to travel as soon as that opportunity could be available. So we are providing them with the information of when we feel we can cruise, which will probably be, you know, later in 2020, and then all of 2021, if God willing, hoping for a really great rebound and opportunities to let these caregivers, along with their loved ones, just enjoy a few minutes of normal life, of give those caregivers a break.
Yeah. Now, for folks who are not familiar with Elite Cruises and Vacations, how do you arrange these cruises, these other ways to give vacations for people with special needs as well as for their caregivers? How do you working with the cruise lines, with the airlines and other organizations, especially at a time like this, trying to basically plan ahead and not really know what's going to come?
Well, we're working with the cruise lines that we have a lot of confidence in,
mm-hmm.
And I am always going to be staffed with professionals, nurses, therapists, at a ratio of 1-4, one caregiver to every 4 travelers. So there's no perfect world and there's no perfect answer, but we're going to try to provide all of the support, education, encouragement that we can. The cruise lines have made a lot of adjustments. For instance, it looks as if the buffet section of the cruise ship will not even be there. When they reopen, that will not be part of the options. And to be honest, we didn't use a lot of buffet options on our cruises. I have always been very concerned about keeping our clients with a medical challenge safe. And so we always encourage them to stay in the dining room, where we can eat together, where they sit at a table and they are served without all of the commotion of a buffet. The buffets are lovely and the food's wonderful, but sometimes too many choices is not what my clients need. And they also don't need that commotion and busy hassle, even when all of things were well and good. So the cruise ships are making a lot of adjustments to ensure that everything is as safe as completely possible. And it looks like those buffets are going to be one of the options that goes for now.
I know you're very lucky, you and other special needs travel agents like yourself, in having these arrangements, having this network, I guess, of cruise companies that really, really care for the people that they have on board their ships and do these things. And, of course, the coronavirus pandemic has just kind of changed everything, for that matter, the whole outlook of travel, especially travel in the seas and taking vacations away from home. So I imagine that they probably are doing things for you they seem to have always done for you, but they may be doing more of these things for the general public someday, I'm sure. But they're using the advantage of learning something from helping folks like you with taking care of people with special needs to come up with these new ideas or different ideas?
I think that that's probably true, and, uh-huh. I would hate to say, oh, yeah, they picked up from what I asked for. That would be an unfair statement, I'm afraid, yeah. But it looks as if that's what's happening.
Well, that's why I wondered.
They will have more space in dining rooms, mm-hmm. More options for sit-down dining, more items on their menu available for sit-down dining. They want to decrease the incredible closeness and clutter of people, and I have always wanted them to do that. For many reasons, for my clients just not being cognitively capable of handling that commotion, but now it appears that that's a really good combination for the general public. Yes, you are correct.
Now, for folks that aren't familiar with how you set up these very special needs cruises and vacations, how are the arrangements that you make off the boat, for that matter, to go see things, places of attractions, places of interest for folks that are on the cruise? Any changes there, or would that basically be the same as well?
It's basically going to be the same. Yeah. I have always provided private tour options for our group. Not mandatory, but most of the clients that travel with me always choose to go with us so that, for number one, we have staff that can always be supportive if they would have a problem. But then I have a private tour company in most of these ports that will take our clients on a tour, let them see and get to take pictures and enjoy their loved ones and get out and see where they're at, but not necessarily spend 6 or 8 hours climbing up a waterfall,
right?
Which is an unrealistic expectation. So that is going to continue. We will absolutely use private transports or private transports through the cruise line so that we have fewer people in a particular van or transportation, or use a lot of open air transportation depending upon the environment that we're in weather-wise, and let people have the opportunity to see in a short duration of time. We try to keep our tours at 2 to 3 hours max, because that's about long enough.
Yeah.
And people need to go back, take a nap, get some rest. St. Thomas is an amazing shopping place, and then we always provide some adult daycare or memory cafe issue so that the family can go out and shop, mm-hmm. and enjoy the good stuff with a little privacy if they prefer. But those situations are individually created for my group, and I believe that the cruise lines are going to make those kind of opportunities a lot more available to the general public. It might make my life easier in the long run. But we'll just have to see how it ends up, how the story ends up in the end here.
Now, Kathy, in the meantime, as you are talking with people making arrangements for cruises, booking cruises as well as arrangements for vacations and the like, what kind of support are you offering to the people that count on you the most to help things make things easy for them? In the meantime, back here at home, anything that you're doing special, any kind of support efforts that you're doing back here?
Well, I have most of my clients hooked into several different caregiving support groups, all of which they have the chance to participate in, if that works into their schedule or their life. But we're really trying to make those more available. The caregivers are really struggling. Most of these caregivers, spouses, adult children, sisters, brothers, they generally use a lot of adult daycare programming. They use memory cafes, so that they have a break too, and none of those processes are functioning right now. So they are literally in I've been calling it house arrest.
Yeah.
Might not be quite true, but I'm sure that that's how they feel. And when you don't have any break at all, it becomes a very overwhelming, fatiguing situation. So we're just trying to be supportive and honest with our options. I have numerous clients that are paid in full to travel with us as soon as the travel's available.
That's great to hear.
And a lot of them don't care where the travel is at or where it's going. Let's just do something. A lot of my clients don't have a long lifespan that will allow them to travel for many, many years. You know, this is a definitive time span for many people, and their loved ones don't want to miss this chance. You know, Dad always wanted to see Alaska, or Mom just wants to go to the Panama Canal, or Mom wants to put her feet in the ocean one more time. You know, sometimes they don't have multiple years to wait for that opportunity.
Well, Kathy, I hear the computer talking to you. It's probably a client wanting to find out more information and get back to you on making arrangements, so I'll let you do that. But thank you very much for spending time with us today here on Lakeshore Public Radio to talk about this, and the best of luck to all of you and everybody who gets involved in Elite Cruises and Vacations. And we know they're going to just love what they do when they actually get a chance to get on the ship and go visit places, and they'll enjoy getting away from all of this for at least a little while, to be sure.
Thank you, sir.
And you're welcome. Kathy Shelf is a registered nurse. She is also the owner and operator of Elite Cruises and Vacations. It's based in Hobart. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
With another edition of Greenfleet Radio, here's Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. Mark Rowe, Senior Manager for Business Development at Trillium. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Happy to be here.
So for those who don't know about Trillium, can you give us a sense of what the company does?
Trillium is a leading provider of renewable fuels and alternative fueling stations in markets and fuels like compressed natural gas, you know, commonly referred to as CNG, hydrogen, electric charging, and solar. We specialize in fuel supply, design, and installation and operations of those alternative fuel stations. And our core customers are, we really run the gamut of fleets, from municipal fleets to transit buses, you know, all the way to trucking and refuse customers. So we work with them all.
So how rare is it for a company to build, maintain, and operate alternative fueling stations?
It's, you know, rare in the grand scheme of transportation and fuel. You know, I would say that alternative fuels is still relatively new. In fact, you know, engine technology and availability in the heavy duty segment really makes, if you look at the fuel like CNG, really only about 10 years new if you think about some of the heavy-duty engines that are available on the market today and are continually improving. But back to your question, not many companies really cover the entire supply chain in the alt-fuel spectrum like Trillium. It's a service that we offer our customers, so they don't really have to go out and work with, you know, multiple vendors and contractors when it comes to integrating, you know, alternative fueling stations into their fleet operations. And that can look a couple different ways. You know, it could be a behind-the-gate private fueling solution for their alternative fuel of choice, or it could be, you know, leveraging the Love network and working with some of the real estate that we have at our disposal at Trillium.
So as you just mentioned, the Love's travel stops, I know our listeners are very well aware who Love's is. So how did that relationship benefit your customer?
Love's is a very big name in transportation. You know, Love's Travel Stops itself has about 500 locations nationwide, and they're continuing to grow. I think average the last few years, opening about 30 or more truck stops every year.
Wow.
As the professional drivers and the traveling public continue to hit the road, you know, their frequency of seeing Love's locations, you know, continues to increase. And, you know, Trillium is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Love's family of companies. So we plug right into the enterprise and, again, have access to that real estate if there's an alternative fuel need for a fleet that we could look at a Love's location to utilize. Alternatively, we can, again, work at behind-the-gate solution for a fleet to have depot charging or fuel at a terminal for some of those professional fleets out there. But certainly a lot of advantages being under Love from a professional standpoint, and we can pass a lot of those on to our customers in the transportation space.
So I know, as you explained, Trillium has rapidly evolved from solely being a compressed natural gas company to where you are today. So why do you think that is?
CNG is certainly a core part of our business, and really is where our roots come from. We've been in business nearly 30 years now. Why CNG in the past, and why diversification forward? So the CNG piece is, it's easy for me, but it never hurts to say it. Those maybe not as familiar with it. You know, natural gas is an abundant domestic fuel. We have a large quantity here in the United States. It's an affordable fuel that has really found its sweet spot in transportation. Why have we expanded past CNG is simply the market is demanding it. CNG has really found its foothold, and it's a technology that is here today. It's available today for all market segments, light, medium, and heavy duty. And we see a lot of investment and effort continuing in natural gas, but also really a lot of excitement and focus on electric transportation going forward. And that's not new for the light duty segment, but certainly seems to have a lot of momentum in the heavy duty space, along with hydrogen. We're really excited about hydrogen as well. Hydrogen is a zero emission fuel. It has the ability to replicate that diesel-like fast fill experience. It's similar to a selling point like natural gas is, where you can get those trucks and buses back on the road quickly. So we see a lot of excitement in hydrogen, especially with transit operators. In fact, we'll soon be opening the nation's largest hydrogen station in California within days.
Congratulations. So can you tell our listeners, what are some of the environmental benefits of hydrogen fueling?
Hydrogen is absolutely a zero-emission fuel. If you think about the transit space, how many millions of people ride public transportation every day? By implementing hydrogen buses and modes of transportation, you're really impacting the emissions profile of those vehicles for those cities that have air quality issues or are certainly interested in environmental improvement.
Where do you think Trillium and Love see the future of alternative fuels? Where's it going?
We see it going up and expanding. The way we look at our position in the marketplace is to be a comprehensive solution provider for the fuel of choice for our customers. And you could say that easier by saying, we really look at our value proposition as one partner, any fuel. We want to work with fleets considering alternative fuels that already have alternative fuels in their portfolio or a combination of the two and try to find solutions that make sense for them, that we can rely on our history of solid project performance, implementation, and again, leveraging the network of a broader and larger company that has real estate available for some of those heavy-duty on-highway applications. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. I think the future is bright and look forward to being a partner for those fleets that are considering or are new to alternative fuels. We're happy to have a conversation and see where it goes.
So how can people learn more about Trillium?
You can hop on our website, trilliumcng.com. If they prefer, just reach out to me directly. The easiest way is probably to just get me by email, mdrowe@trilliumcng.com.
Well, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mark Rowe, Senior Manager for Business Development at Trillium. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
That's Carl Lissick, host of Green Fleet Radio, talking with B. Mark Rowe, Senior Manager, Business Development at Trillium. Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. You can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Coming up on February 11th is going to be the ordination and in turn the liturgy for the fifth bishop of the Diocese of Gary here in Northwest Indiana. We have with us now the two people that know what the procedure is going to be the best, what's happening on February 11th. We have Father Marty Dobrinsky and we have Father Mike Yadrin. Father Dobrinsky is one of the organizers of the liturgical event coming up, and Father Mike Yadrin is the current administrator for the diocese. He took over when Bishop Donald Hying left to become the bishop in Madison, Wisconsin, back in last April, and he is going to, in turn, help guide, I guess, the new bishop to the job that he is going to be taking on, leading a very, very active and very populous Diocese of Gary. And Father Marty and Father Mike, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
You're welcome. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
First, Father Marty, I'll let you give us an idea of what the event coming up on February 11th is going to look and sound like.
Well, February 11th will be the ordination and installation of Bishop-elect McClory, and it will be quite an event. It's the Cathedral seats, a little less than 800. And so that means that we have to watch the number of people coming. So it's a ticketed event, but it's going to be broadcast on the Internet through our website, mm-hmm. and on EWTN and Catholic Television.
Wow.
And which are both cable channels. And I think we're working on trying to make an arrangement for a later broadcast on Lakeshore Television, mm-hmm. As well. But so we're very excited about it. And been a lot of planning going into it and a lot of work in preparation for it. And we will begin with around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We have some 40-some bishops presently that are going to be there, over 100 priests and deacons as well, it's about 60 deacons. And then probably close to 800 guests that we will shoehorn into the cathedral for the event. So each parish has two representatives coming, and then there are representatives for the religious communities, the sisters, etc., and also then the bishop's elect's family and his family and close associates from Detroit who will be coming down for the event as well. So it'll be a pretty packed event, and it pretty much looks like if you've ever been to a ordination of a priest, it pretty much looks the same. So we begin Mass as usual, and then after the Gospel is read, the bishop is introduced by one of our priests, one of our youngest priests, Father Declan McNichols, will be one of the assisting priests for the bishop-elect, and he will introduce him to the Archbishop of Indianapolis, who is the main celebrant for the beginning part of the Mass. Mm-hmm. The Archbishop of Indianapolis, Archbishop Thompson, is our provincial. Each collection of dioceses is put into a province. For most of us, it's a state. So for us, it's the state of Indiana, and the Archbishop is the Archbishop of Indianapolis. So he has the permission or what have you. He's the one who does the ordaining. And so he will be presented to the Archbishop by Father Declan, and then the whole thing proceeds from there. So it's very interesting, and I would suggest to people, if they're really to watch it online, and also you'll be able to download online a PDF of the Mass program. And the good thing about in the program for the Mass is there is very nice little explanations of all the different things that are going to happen during the ordination rite itself.
Well, I guess the sports analogy was you can't tell the players without a scorecard, right?
And, that's right. Can't tell the players without
right.
a program.
Yeah, that's right. That's
so
right.
Yeah, so it'll be a good guide for all of that. Mm-hmm. In addition, on the night before, there is an evening prayer, which is customary, that happens. And at the evening prayer will be, not at the cathedral, it will be at St. Michael's in Schererville, which is the second of our two parishes dedicated to the angels, which are the patrons of the diocese. And at the evening prayer, too, you'll be able to download that program as well. And though St. Michael's is a bigger church, it's still... we still have tickets, you know, but there's a little larger parish representation at that, et cetera, et cetera. But we encourage people to really go online and just enjoy and pray together online for those events as well.
Now, Father Marty, did you have an opportunity to participate in helping organize the last one, which was for Bishop Hying?
Yes.
What was it? Will we find the same similarities in the programs, the events?
It'll be substantially different because Bishop Hying came to us already ordained as mm-hmm. a bishop.
Yeah.
So this is substantially different from the very get-go. That liturgy at the very beginning, there's all kinds of things that happen before we even do the readings where he takes possession of the diocese and et cetera, et cetera. In this liturgy, Bishop-elect McClory is sitting right outside the presbytery in the cathedral, so he'll be between the altar and the bishop's chair, flanked by two assisting priests. So he's still a priest. Mm-hmm. And so the whole first half of the liturgy is presided over by Archbishop Thompson through the ordination rite. And then after the ordination rite, which happens pretty much like after the homily, mm-hmm. he is now the bishop. And now he becomes the main celebrant of the liturgy.
That's interesting.
So it's very, very different than just an installation.
The other thing that's substantially different about it, too, is that we're going to have oodles more bishops here, because when it's a bishop being transferred from one diocese to another, they merely come in to take possession of the diocese, and you might have a couple of visiting bishops, but not many. However, when a priest is being ordained a bishop, there are a lot of bishops that attend the ceremony, so we've got a lot more of that going on as well.
Father Mike, tell us a little bit about what you as the administrator of the diocese, kind of being the mediary, I guess, between the former bishop, Bishop Hyang, and now the bishop-elect, Bishop McClory, coming in. What kinds of things do you get to do to help prepare Bishop-elect McClory for his new role?
As soon as he was named a bishop by the Pope, the Apostolic Nuncio called me to let me know who our new bishop was going to be and instructed me to call him so that we could have our initial conversation as well as set the date for the announcement. From the very beginning, we were working about his public announcement, what he was going to be doing, when he could come in. I've been in conversation with him several times by phone, many more times text or email, in order to get him ready. When he came in for his announcement, you know, we had the press conference, and then after the press conference, he had mass for our pastoral center staff so that he could meet the people that are going to be working with him. And after that, we went to visit a school, and we went to see the cathedral where he was going to be ordained. So there was a lot just in that first day. And then, as I say, in initial conversations, just kind of trying to bring him up to speed on some of the things that are happening, but there's not going to be any way to bring anybody up to speed until they're actually here. You know, It's kind of like being a bishop. One of the first things I learned in these past several months, it's like jumping into the deep end of the pool. You know, you just got to jump in and hope he can swim.
Well,
so
that's
I'll be there to back him up, you know, with whatever he might need. And I'm sure I'll be around for a little bit of a while, you know, just to give him history and context on some of the decisions that have been made or some of the programs that we're doing, and just do the best I can to support him in his role as our bishop.
I know that I'm sure he's very interested, and you've kept him up to speed on what's happening with the school system within the Diocese of Gary, and the Big Shoulders Fund, and the program is being established with the help of the folks here in Northwest Indiana to make the school system stronger and much better. So he's I'm sure very excited about getting involved in that.
He is. He's very committed to Catholic education, which excites all of us. And that's one of the reasons why his first visit, he wanted it to be at a school. And he's very excited about Big Shoulders coming in to help us. So they're going to be able to provide a lot of work for us and help for us in terms of, like, some of professional development and other kind of issues. In other dioceses, they provide a lot more cash benefits. Since our diocese, we're in Indiana, so we can benefit from the voucher program. A lot of the money that Big Shoulders is going to be giving to our diocese will go in terms of professional development, in terms of looking for good administrators, in helping the teachers, you know, those kinds of things. So it's something all the schools can benefit from.
Now let me ask, Father Mikey, is there a website that people can check if they'd like to check it ahead of the February 11th ordination and the installation of the new bishop?
Oh, yeah, they can go to the diocesan website. It's www.dcgary.org, and there's a link for the ordinations right there.
We're speaking with Father Mike Adron. He's the administrator for the Diocese of Gary until the bishop-elect McClory is ordained and takes over, and also with Father Marty Dobrinsky, who is, along with others, working on getting the liturgical events lined up. That's going to happen on February 11th at the Cathedral in Gary. Robert McClory has been a student, a lawyer, a seminarian, a pastor, and a chancellor, and now he is taking on a new challenge as the fifth bishop of the Diocese of Gary. Bishop McClory, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's a delight to be with you, Chris, and a hearty hello and blessings to all your listeners.
Thank you very much. I've had an opportunity to take a look at some of the information about your background, not only personal background, but also, too, about your religious background. Tell us first, I guess, about yourself and the position that you are coming from there in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Yeah, so currently I serve as the pastor and the rector of the National Shrine of the Little Flower, which is a basilica in Royal Oak, Michigan. It's a large and vibrant parish. We have 4,500 families. We've got a beautiful and historical edifice, along with pre-K through 12 high school. So it's a wonderful place to serve the people of God, and hopefully it's prepared me to serve an even wider flock in Northwest Indiana.
I have a very extensive Catholic education, starting from grade school there in Detroit, and moving on to other schools as well. You moved on, I guess, into secular college, I understand, in fact, into a secular career. Tell us what prompted you to make the shift from college, and included attending University of Michigan and get a law degree and practice in law, into, I guess, the calling for the priesthood.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. You know, even in my study of the law, and I had previously studied public policy with some interest in economic development, I always looked for ways to be of service, to try and make a contribution to the greater good. And so certainly that expressed itself in some interest in the law and public policy. And I think as my journey of faith continued to grow, what I realized is that the most important thing that I can give people is really the loving outreach that God wants us all to give. And so I began to reflect more fully on what God might be calling me to, and certainly I think he uses all of our background, and so my background in law and in public policy hopefully will serve as well as I'm in a pastoral role in the Diocese of Gary. But that motivation just continued to grow and express itself, and I thought, if I gave myself completely to serving Jesus in the ministry, I think that's really the best way that God would use me to have an impact on the lives of others.
When you took up the priesthood, Quebec was ordained as a priest in May of 1999, did you have any thought at all about the possibility that you would end up being a bishop?
I did not. You know, this is something that just comes suddenly, and your life has changed in an instant. And so, really, I had no idea until I received a phone call from someone called the Papal Nuncio. It's like the Pope's ambassador to the United States, but also his delegate to the Church in the United States. And he called me up and said, "The Holy Father has appointed you the Bishop of Gary." And I said, I knew it was Gary. He said, "Gary." I said, "I am delighted." And I said, "If that's the Holy Father's wishes, I'll be happy to fulfill that." I said, "I don't think I'm worthy, but if the Holy Father wants me, then I'll do my best." And so he was very grateful for that. And my life was suddenly changed, and all changed for the good. The people of Gary have been so loving and kind and supportive, and the people of the region that I've had a chance to encounter have genuinely given me the love and embrace, which I'm very grateful for.
One of the things I noticed in getting ready for our conversation was that it's interesting that you, being the Bishop of McClory, will be when your ordination happens here in February, as actually going to be Gary's second bishop with some Detroit ties. You being a native of Detroit and the region and in Michigan, it's interesting that Bishop Dale Melchick, who was the bishop previous to you back, was also involved in the priesthood in Detroit.
Yes, and for me, that's been just a tremendous blessing. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to meet and converse with Bishop Melchick on several occasions. He certainly had an excellent reputation in Detroit for his service here. And then, you know, from afar, not too far away, Detroit and Gary aren't that far away, the opportunity to just really appreciate and admire all that he's done there. One of the special blessings that the timing of my announcement as the bishop was just before something called an ad limina visit, which is a visit of the bishops of a particular region to Rome to meet with the Pope and also to pray at some of the holy sites. So during that occasion, which was a week in Rome, I was with Bishop Melchick during that time, as well as Bishop Donald Hying, who had immediately succeeded Bishop Melchick for the last 5.5 years. And so that was a wonderful way to be kind of welcomed into the fraternity that is in Gary.
Had you had the chance ever to visit Vatican City in the past, or was that your first visit?
Well, it was the first time that I met Pope Francis. I did study in Rome, so I was there for 5 years. During that time, it would have been St. John Paul II. So it was a real treat to be able to meet Pope Francis, and not just meet him, but we were in a setting where he meets with groups of bishops. So there were about 25 of us bishops from Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And we had about a two-and-a-half-hour meeting with Pope Francis, which was a real delight.
In the transition here from being involved in the diocese and archdiocese in Detroit, coming to become the bishop of the Diocese of Gary, are there any similarities? Are there any differences between the two?
Well, I'd like to think that there are. I, you know, certainly don't want to presume Gary's history to some significant degree. I'll be welcomed, and that'll become my new home very shortly. But I think to the extent that we're both, you know, part of the industrial Great Lakes, that there are some commonalities. Certainly the presence of a dominant industry that experienced some transformation and some periods of economic downturns, both in Detroit, heavily reliant on the auto industry, and of course Gary, historically identified with the steel industry. Our communities can be highly sensitive to economic fluctuations and also, you know, the dislocation that can occur when such economic downturns take place. So having that experience, I hope, will give me a sense of compassion and understanding as I come to Gary. But I would also say, you know, I'm a healthily proud son of Detroit, and I will be a proud son of Gary. And I think sometimes those communities, perhaps, that have had some similar struggles can almost begin to feel a little bit like we're marginalized, and that's certainly not God's plan. God's love is for all of us, and even if you know, the rest of the world doesn't know all the gifts that we have, we know the gifts that we have. And so I really hope to bring a message of encouragement and hopefulness and God's love, and I think some of my experience in Detroit may be transferable into Gary, just having a kind of a sensitivity what it means to be in communities that have gone through those changes and struggles and come out for the better ultimately because of it.
Are there any special plans that in the meantime that you have thought about between the time that the announcement came out in November and your impending ordination and installation as the bishop? Anything special that you have maybe in mind for the folks here of the Diocese of Gary?
Well, this has been a real time of information gathering for me, of course, planning some of the logistics of the liturgy itself that will be occurring. But as I look beyond February 11th, there are probably about three areas that I think would be good for me to focus on, three or four. I mean, initially, as I said, just being a presence of hope and encouragement. We're in the midst of finalizing a public schedule so that after the 11th, I'll be having the opportunity to have masses or opportunities to be at some significant events throughout the four counties. Beyond that would be really to get to know the needs of the flock in Gary so that I can listen and I can receive and get a deeper appreciation for what the people of Gary might need and want at this time. The third area that I'm very privileged to be able to build upon is that Bishop Hying in 2017 had what's called a diocesan synod, and that's a pretty rare occurrence in the life of a diocese. And so that was a convening of leaders and a time of reflection for the whole Diocese of Gary that occurred in 2017, and so that laid forth some pastoral priorities, some areas that we need to focus on in terms of evangelization and service to others, and so I feel as though that will give me a foundation to be able to reach out and have some guideposts as I begin to minister. And then finally, of course, I'm coming as the Catholic bishop, the Roman Catholic bishop, to the Diocese of Gary, but I also see myself as having a responsibility to be a good member of the wider community, to make sure that people understand that the Catholic Church, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you have another faith or no faith, that we exist to bring to be good neighbors, to bring God's love, and to do our part in the wider community. So that's also something that I see as significant when I come into Gary.
Well, Bishop Robert McClory, thank you very much for speaking with us, and we look forward to having a chance to meet you when you do make your visit and become the new bishop of the Diocese of Gary on February 11th. Thank you for spending some time talking today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
A programming note from Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Governor Eric Holcomb will provide updates on COVID-19 and its impact to the Hoosier State every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 1:30 in the afternoon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Tuesdays and Thursdays will be reserved for emergency updates regarding COVID-19 as needed by the governor. You can also watch the press conferences on our sister station, Lakeshore PBS, or on Facebook. Search for Lakeshore Public Radio.
You're listening to a best of Regionally Speaking. Chicago area nonprofit fund is going to take a big project in hand, a first for Northwest Indiana. The Big Shoulders Fund CEO Josh Hale was with us to talk about a multi-year project with the Catholic Diocese of Gary School District, and it's being supported by a generous gift from the Bruce and Beth White Family Foundation. Hale talks first about the Big Shoulders organization, and then he talks in particular about the White's involvement in the project.
Big Shoulders Fund is a nonprofit, independent charitable organization that was founded back in 1986 at the inspiration of Cardinal Bernardine, but by a group of business and civic leaders who were working really overall to strengthen the city of Chicago by really ensuring that all children have access to a quality education. And the second largest system of schools then and now is the Catholic schools. Mm-hmm. And so they came together and formed this this foundation, really to raise funds to provide access, how to assure that every child found the right school, their parents knew that they were in the right place in a safe and structured environment. And over time, you know, at the onset, we were primarily focused on scholarships, but over time, we have really broadened our investments to focus certainly on the child, ensuring that he or she has the resources to attend the school of their choice, but also that they have the supports, and that's, you know, whether it's after school or before school, it's tutoring, it's coach, whatever it is, mentorship, and really kind of surrounding the child with all the tools they need to succeed from elementary school to high school and really then into college. But we also started to invest in ensuring that these schools we support remain open and viable. You know, first and foremost, these schools represent a community-based organization in the neighborhoods they serve. A beacon of hope, a open and operating institution, and we want to make sure that they were not only open, but that they provided the very best product. So we've increasingly invested in teachers and classrooms, and that's everything from recruiting teachers into a pipeline from right out of college into our classrooms, supporting them, coaching them, helping them to understand the data associated with each of their students, finding great curriculum, and then training them and supporting them, and helping really students to succeed at a higher level. And so academics in the classroom are a big part of it, and creating a pipeline of teachers and principals over time. Mm-hmm. And then the third area is really the business side of the school, because at the end of the day, these inner-city Catholic schools are about a $1 to $1.5 million business. And so we really work with a principal who's primarily an academic leader, but has been asked to really run the quote-unquote business. So helping them with operational support, whether that's cash flow management or it's budgeting or developing a long-term plan or marketing, all those things that come into running a small business successfully. And the third area really is leadership. How do we help overall not only attract and develop the best principals, but retain them over time? We work with 75 schools here in Chicago. It's about 20,000 children, 80% minority, about 70% poverty. And I would say their success rate is what we really hang our hat on, is that it's great that we have these schools open as community-based organizations. It's great to provide access and we invest. But we also want to know that these students really go on to succeed in life and to become great citizens. We graduate, our high schools see about a 94% graduation rate. Our scholars go on to college at very high rates. We see them not only graduating high school, but actually enrolling in high school at about 86%. And then we see about 92% of them persist. And of those going on to college, 80-plus percent are going to four-year universities. And then the long term, you know, as they matriculate through college, we see that our students are graduating college at two times the national rate. And for African-American and Hispanic students, that's three times and four times, respectively. They're employed at a higher rate than their peers. They're volunteering at a higher rate than their peers. They're earning at a higher rate than their peers. But they're also donating to charities. They're active in the community and really becoming the citizens that we all dream they could become. And I think that's ultimately our long-term goal, is really to make sure these students from under-resourced communities become the citizens and contribute to society that we all know they can become.
Mm-hmm. How did Big Shoulders... I'm sorry.
That's a kind of a nutshell of how we work mm-hmm. at Big Shoulders Fund. Right. And we're very excited about this opportunity. Yeah. To be invited into and starting our work in Northwest Indiana. And, you know, we really, given our mission is to serve in under-resourced communities, the invitation of Beth and Bruce White to develop a program, the openness, the enthusiasm of all the folks we've met in Northwest Indiana, from community leaders to families to principals in the diocese, has been overwhelming. And we share a lot of the same values and desires, and we're very hopeful.
How did the Big Shoulders Fund get together with the White Family Foundation to take up this topic, and certainly to take up this long range, since we're talking about $16 million over a decade, $16 million that's going to be eventually being invested into the Catholic schools?
Yeah, we got to know Beth and Bruce, who's both their roots are in Indiana. Bruce, obviously, from Northwest Indiana, and Beth from Southwest Indiana. And they were living in Chicago, had moved here about a decade ago, and some friends on our board introduced them to Big Shoals Fund. And they were enthusiastic about the mission right from the get-go, and they got involved with one of our schools in the far southeast side of Chicago, which is just on the border of Indiana, and a school that was really struggling and but provided a great outcome. With Beth and Bruce, what I've learned is when they get involved, they get involved. And they got not only themselves involved as mentors, but they invited their children. They invited their friends. And they have many mentors of these students now. And I love, you know, Beth and Bruce come back and talk to us about the students they've been out visiting, the students' performances they've gone to see. They invite their scholars down for shows. So hands-on involved in the mission, really active. And, you know, I think the mission fell in love with Beth and Bruce as much as they fell in love with the mission.
It's Josh Hale with the Big Shoulders Fund of Chicago, which is working with the Diocese of Gary Schools. And that's it for a special edition of Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll tune into Regionally Speaking tomorrow.